Okay, so we've got some more questions here, which you have no choice but to ask. And I've got no choice but to answer. So I don't blame you, I don't blame anybody. You all know Ajahn Chah's famous saying about blaming others. If you have any problem in your life, you blame somebody else, it's like having an itch on your bottom and scratching your head. If you blame someone else for problems, what happens is you just get two itches. Like we have an itch on your bottom, you scratch your head, two places itch. So I never blame anybody. The first question here. During the time of the Buddha, people, monks, lay people, including even courtesans, became stream winners without any mention of meditation by listening to the Buddha's teachings. In the case of Svetl Sariputta, he only listened to two lines of a stanza uttered by Venerable Asaji. It seems then that he did not do any meditation. Please comment. Thank you, Ajahn. You know, I've been to some people's houses and I see the pictures of their sons and their daughters who have got these degrees from universities. And to get your degree, according to the photographs, all you need to do is to show up in a nice suit and gown. And then they give you this little piece of paper and then you've got your degree. At least that's the only thing recorded in the scrapbooks and on the photographs of your wall. But the point is, do you ever take photographs of your children going to their lectures or doing their homework or writing out their assignments? Are there any photographs of doing their final examinations? No, we only get the photograph of the final events. Or like, you know, when you get married, you have the photographs of your wedding, but it doesn't say anything about how you got to that place. And it's the same with the suttas. Sometimes, just like your wedding albums, they only show the final pinnacle of the achievements of getting married. What happens in the suttas. Like Venerable Sariputta, they only give that final straw which broke the camel's back, that final event when he just got the last piece of the jigsaw so he could become a stream winner. It doesn't show all the other things which have went on beforehand. Because the story of Sariputta, for example, that he was with this other teacher, Sanjaya, for many, many years. So it's almost certainly he was meditating beforehand. He was like an ascetic. He left the world with his friend Moggallana. So the two of these, they would have been meditating before. But, just like in your wedding albums, you only show the final event. You don't show all of the hard work which got you to that place. So your mind was open at that time to that just one teaching which made them fully enlightened. But for that particular question, you will hear more about that this evening when we talk about enlightenment itself and how it happens. But if you're already enlightened or you get enlightened between now and then you don't have to come to the talk. But if you're not enlightened, you have to come. Ajahn, how to maintain the stillness and the silence of the mind? Thank you, Ajahn. Shall we just be aware when the silent mind is start to be disturbed by thoughts and let it be silent again on its own pace? Yeah, it's very easy to maintain the silence. Just don't do anything. You know what I said? The basic, what I've been teaching all my monks in Perth, the basic instructions in meditation, sit down, shut up, and be mindful. That's all you need to do. Stop disturbing the process. You're finally still. You finally got there. And what do? You mess it all up. Ah, at last I'm still, you say. And then you're not still anymore. Be quiet. You know that old joke about those four monks and a vow of silence? And one monk sneezed. The first monk said, bless you. The second monk said, "You've broken your vow of silence." The third monk said, "Ha ha, so have you." And the fourth monk said, "I'm glad I'm the only one here who can keep quiet." Now the point is that every time you make a comment, you disturb the mind. So after a while, you get this skill of just leaving things alone, relaxing, and not worrying. You probably heard me give you the symbol of the bicycle before. I remember when I was a young boy, and for a birthday present I got my first bicycle. And I was so excited, I couldn't wait to get on it and start riding it. However, as a young boy, when you first ride a bicycle, it takes a lot of skill to balance. But because I was so afraid of falling off, I gripped those handlebars so tight, my knuckles went white. And because I was so afraid and I was so stiff, I kept on falling off. It's only later you realize the best way to stay upright on a bicycle is completely relax. And when you completely relax, your body just moves as it's required. But if you're stiff, you always fall off. It's the same way with meditation. If you hold on too tightly, you're so stiff, no wonder you keep falling off and go off into sloth and torpor or go off into restlessness. You're falling off the bicycle because you are holding on too hard. You just really relax. You stay still. So, the best way of staying still is relax even more. The less you do, the longer you're peaceful. So, it's very easy once you get the idea, you just do nothing because you're still. People say, "How do you do that?" You say, "Stupid question, friend. It's how you don't do, not how you do things. How you stop all this doing." And the best way to stop all this doing is have nowhere to go, nothing to achieve, no destination. I just realized today there's only 2 days of the retreat left. Are you still trying to get somewhere? If you are, the only place you're going to get to is Dukkhaville, the city of suffering. So don't try and get anywhere in these last 2 days. Just be here. Just enjoy the moment. Don't try and get anywhere at all. The more you try, the faster that clock is going to turn. So just let go and enjoy every moment of Club Med. So just be aware when the silent mind. Don't do anything. And it's a teaching I said on the first day, but I'll reinforce it now. In meditation, it does not matter what you're experiencing. What is important is how you are experiencing it. It's not the subject of your mind, it's actually what you're doing about it. That's the problem. No matter what you're experiencing it, if you are at peace with it, you accept it, you allow it to be, you're content with it, then you're on the path to Nibbana, to deep meditation. You're making peace. You're not doing anything. You're not pushing the cart. So if you are trying to get somewhere, you're not happy where you are, you want to be somewhere else, you want to get somewhere else, you want more, you want deeper, you want this, you want that, you don't like this, then you're making suffering for yourself. And your meditation will never be successful that way. So it doesn't matter what you're experiencing, ask yourself, how am I experiencing this? Put some of your mindfulness right there. So really, it doesn't matter if you're watching the breath, or you're watching the silence, or watching your nimitta. What's crucial is how you're watching those things. If you're watching a nimitta and you're just holding on to it tightly, you're never going to get anywhere. If you're watching the breath and it's just so calm, you're watching the breath, you're going to get very deep. Even if you're restless and you're watching the breath and, "Oh, this is good enough for me, this is silent, this is peaceful," you're just allowing it to be, then you're going to go very deep, very quickly. It's not what you're doing, it's how you're doing it. All the defilements, all the hindrances, where are they? Is the suffering with the breath? Is the craving with the breath? Is the craving with the nimitta? No, the craving is between you and those things. So that's where the defilements live. Dhirajan, are bodhisattvas enlightened beings? Is quite yet a bodhisattva. Who has attained a high level, bodhisattva or arahat? Thank you. Okay. Oops. The bodhisattva is a being on the path to being enlightenment. So they're not enlightened yet. And really, this, to go to the original teachings of the Buddha, there's this wonderful sutta called the Gatikara Sutta. And it's really well worth you having a read of it. Gatikara, G-H-A-T-I-K-A-R-A. The Majjhima Nikaya. Have a look at that one day. Because Gatikara, he was a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha, which is the Buddha previous to Siddhartha Gautama. And he was such a devout disciple. I mentioned him tonight probably because he was a non-returner, an anagami. And he was the one who'd make pots but would never actually dig the earth. He would never sell those pots. He'd put them on the table, say, if anyone wanted a pot, please take them. If you want to leave some rice and lentils, just leave them. He would not go into buying and selling. And the only reason he wasn't a monk himself under Kassapa the Buddha was because of his blind parents, which he had to look after. But what I had never mentioned before was that Gatikara had a best friend called Jyotipala, who was a Brahmin. And Jyotipala was like a bit of a businessman, and he did not like this Buddhism business. And every time Gatikara started twittering on about this amazing Kassapa the Buddha, Jyotipala would always just be so coarse and say, that's a shaven-headed, good-for-nothing Kassapa the Buddha. Who wants to go there? You should get a proper job instead of just meditating all day. And Jyotipala really said some rotten things about Kassapa the Buddha. But Gatikara was determined to get his best friend to go and listen to Kassapa and become a faithful Buddhist. Just like some of you might have a really good friend who doesn't like Buddhism at all, who would never go to the temple, and you say, if I can only get them once to come and listen to a CD or get some sort of faith, because they're always saying bad things about Buddhism, about monks. You know, you have friends like that, or you know people like that? Jyotipala was a person like that. So Gatikara, the whole first half of this sutra was how Gatikara managed to trick his friend Jyotipala to go and see Kassapa the Buddha. And as soon as his friend Jyotipala saw Kassapa the Buddha, he immediately got a lot of faith. He listened to the teachings of such a Buddha and he was convinced. And actually he became a monk. This Jyotipala, the Brahmin, ordained under Kassapa the Buddha. And the sutta stops off there and goes into another story with Gatikara. But the end of the sutta, which was taught by the Buddha, our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, he said, in my previous life, I was Jyotipala, the Brahmin. He says in the sutra itself, that was him, a previous life. The Buddha had ordained, our Buddha, had ordained under Jyoti, under Kassapa the Buddha. And that is reinforced in another sutra in the Sagyutta Nikaya, when just after the Buddha, our Buddha, Siddhartha Buddha, became enlightened in Bodh Gaya, who would come and visit him to give his congratulations? Then Gatikara, who was now an anagami, reborn in the pure abodes. And so that deva Gatikara, after the Buddha's enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, came down and congratulated Siddhartha Gautama. Congratulations, you are now a Buddha. We used to live in the same village under the time of the previous Buddha, Kassapa. There's a lot of very fascinating information in that sutta. First of all, there we have a very recent life of Siddhartha Gautama Buddha. Because according to all of our traditions, Kassapa the Buddha was actually in this very same eon. So in the cosmic scale of Buddhism, that's not that long ago. So there was our Buddha to be, who was so unenlightened he couldn't even recognize another Buddha, or would actually say bad things about him. Now that's a bodhisattva, a being about to become enlightened very soon, was still so unenlightened he would even say bad things and make bad karma about a Buddha. Now that's what a bodhisattva is like. So, very fascinating. A bodhisattva is unenlightened. That's what it means, a bodhisattva, being on the way to being enlightened. And unless you're fully enlightened, then you are, well, just basically full of delusion. So that's the difference between a bodhisattva and an arahat. And for the best within the world, the arahats, the enlightened ones, are always superior than the bodhisattvas. But I'll mention some more about that, and more about the Gatikara Sutta afterwards. I may have made mention of it now because I started. If our Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, was actually a monk, had ordained under the Buddha Kassapa, and he had obviously incredible parameters, it was the next Buddha to be, don't you think that he would have at least understood something about Kassapa the Buddha's teachings? Don't you think he might even have been a stream winner, or might even have been a once returner? There's an ancient sect of Buddhism called the Sotrantikas, who actually also saw that and claimed with very good justification that Jodhipala under Kassapa the Buddha attained to the stage of Sakadagami, a once returner. Because it also says in the sutras that most once returners, Sakadagamis, this is the second stage of enlightenment, which I mentioned this evening, most Sakadagamis get reborn in the Tusita realm. We all know, according to the stories, that Siddhartha Gautama came to this earth from the Tusita realm. So when Siddhartha Gautama was born at Lumbini, was he already a Sakadagami? A once returner? According to all our legends, including the Theravada, when the Buddha was born, he took seven steps, put up his finger and says, "I am the best, I am the chief, this is my last birth." That's the sort of thing a once returner would say. A Sakadagami, only coming back once. And this is why I say that a Buddha is a Sakadagami, reborn at a time when there's no other Buddhism, no teaching, no Dhamma available, and who decides to teach. I know it's our tradition said the Buddha was a self-enlightened being, found it out all by himself. Is that possible? Or even feasible? Certainly, we know from the Buddha's own words that he was a monk under Kassapa the Buddha. And the first attainment which he got under the Bodhi tree before his full enlightenment was remembering his past lives. I've asked some of you to see if you can remember your past lives. If you had a life, say, under this Buddha, that would be quite an amazing experience, wouldn't it? If you could remember that you were a monk or a nun or a lay person under Siddhartha Gautama at that time, you'd have all the original teachings. Then you know whether it's Mahayana, Vajrayana or Theravada was the correct teachings, because you could remember what the Buddha actually said. Wouldn't that be interesting? Imagine Siddhartha Gautama. He remembered being under Kassapa. He remembered his previous lives under the first watch of the night, under the Bodhi tree, before his enlightenment. If he remembered being under Kassapa the Buddha, surely he would have remembered some of the teachings, such as the Four Noble Truths, because he'd heard them before. So, that was the seed, that was the paratagosa, the words of another, which seeded our Buddha's enlightenment, remembering the teachings he'd heard under Kassapa the Buddha was all he needed. So the Buddha wasn't just taught by himself. He recalled teachings from his previous life under the most recent Buddha. Anyway, more about that this evening. Apart from Pali, I believe are also originally Buddhist texts written in Sanskrit. Are these the later Buddhist texts? Why were they in Sanskrit? Thank you. In the original Buddhist texts, they were just in the local language. They were not written down. They were just recited in the local lingo. So, if in those days, all the sutras, all the teachings, if they came to Ipoh, they would be in Bahasa Malay, or they would be in Cantonese or Mandarin, or Hokkien in Ipoh. Cantonese, they would be in Cantonese. So they'd use a local language. But there was not that much difference in India at the time between the local languages. It was just like local dialects, that's all. So everybody can understand one another. Even though there are a few special words and special districts, there was enough trade going right throughout India at the time that everybody could understand everybody else. However, there were just slightly different dialects. Very similar to the Sanskrit and the Pali, like Dhamma. One is Dhamma with an R, the other one is Dhamma. So there's hardly any difference at all. Just a slightly different pronunciation. Or like Kashyapa or Kashyapa for the previous Buddha. Slightly different, but not much. So everyone could understand each other. And the Pali came about because Mahinda, the Arahant Mahinda, Asoka's son, who brought Buddhism to Sri Lanka, he brought the books in the language, I think it was called Avanti, roughly where the old stupa Sanchi is, this famous old Buddhist stupa in India. That's where he left India and came to Sri Lanka, and basically the language of Pali was the language at that time in that place, which got frozen when it got taken to Sri Lanka, became sort of the religious language for the Buddhist texts. But of course, when they were written down, about 100 BC, then that became a frozen language, the language of Pali. Literally, the language Pali, Pali Bhasa, same actually with Bahasa. Bahasa is actually comes from the Pali Sanskrit, Bhasa. B-H-A-S-A. It's an Indian word. And that literally means the language of the texts, or the language of the palm leaves, the Pali. And that's where it got its name from. So in Theravada, they had this old Pali. Later on in India, Sanskrit itself became like a classical language. It was supposed to be the most perfect of all languages, as the Indians would say. And it's true, it is much more rational and logical than Pali, which is why many people, they learn Sanskrit first of all, which is nice and logical, and then they go to Pali afterwards. However, because Sanskrit was supposed to be sort of a much higher language, they thought these Buddhist teachings, they deserve to be retranslated into the more perfect language. And so many of the texts were actually retranslated back into Sanskrit. And the Sanskrit texts are always the much later ones. So Pali was more original, and then it was translated back, but it doesn't really mean much translation, it's more like transliterated back. So instead of like, you know, the law of karma, K-A-M-M-A, it became karma, K-A-R-M-A. Just little things like that. And that's where the Sanskrit came from. But the usual, the Sanskrit texts which you have are always much later than the Pali ones. That's where it came from. There's not much difference there. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if a son wishes to renounce to become a monk, he asks permission from his mother. If his mother doesn't give her blessing, what will be the karma for his mother? Whoa. Now this is going to scare you, but it is true. If any person stands in the way of someone else doing good karma, they commit very bad karma. So, for example, say that your husband wants to come on a retreat. You say, no, you can't go. You're standing in his way of doing good karma. So by saying no, you make bad karma. If, say, your wife wants to give a donation to the temple, you say, no, 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 don't do that. You can't afford it. It's stupid. If you stand in the way of someone doing good karma, you make bad karma. Now, if you want to keep the five precepts, and your father says, "No, don't be stupid, don't do that. Come out, we're having a party tonight. Now I want you to drink." You say, "No, I want to keep the five precepts." "No, drink." He's actually creating bad karma by not allowing you to do good karma. And it's the same way that if you have a son or a daughter who has a legitimate wish, and obviously that they are able to become a monk or a nun, they're not crazy, they're not giving up their responsibilities, but they're doing it in the proper way, the right way, and you just say for no real reason, "No, you can't do it. You commit bad karma." Imagine if my mother, when I asked her over 30 years ago, "Can I be a monk?" if she said no, then imagine the bad karma she would have made. In the opposite way, if you encourage someone to do good karma, if you encourage them to come to the temple, if you ring them up and say, "There's a good talk on tonight, come over to the temple, you'll enjoy it." Or if you say, "You know, these five precepts are so great, you should keep the five precepts as well." Or if you say, "Come on, you can do a retreat, it's not that bad, Ajahn Brahm's retreats are really soft, you can sleep as much as you like, it's not hard at all, come on, you can go." And they do go, you have made great good karma. If you encourage other people to do good karma, then you make good karma. If you stop people making good karma, you make bad karma. That's a general rule. That's why we should always be encouraging other people in acts of goodness, kindness and generosity. We should never stop them. So if someone wants to be a monk or a nun, please, you should encourage them. Obviously, if they've got what it takes. If they're crazy, or they're just running away because of they can't face their responsibilities, or they've just got some romantic idea, or just, you know, because your son has just finished a relationship and they've got a broken heart, and they say, "It's either become a monk or suicide, I can't stand life any longer." If it's stupid romance like that, just say, "No," because they're going into the monastic order for the wrong reasons. Ajahn Brahm, precept number 5, no drug, no alcohol. "I have a habit of taking 10 milliliters of tonic wine for general health and elevate blood pressure every night. I have low blood pressure. Is that allowable?" 10 milliliters, that's not very much, is it? I don't know. Really depends on how pure alcohol it is, I suppose, and how much alcohol is in that 10 milliliters. But basically, you know, if it doesn't affect your mindfulness, and actually even a small amount of alcohol does affect your mindfulness, if it really is just such a small amount that you can't really tell the difference, then it's okay. But if it can tell the difference, and most policemen, when they take your blood alcohol level, they know that even a small amount of blood alcohol actually affects your ability to react to the changing situations of traffic. I know that it's usually like legal limits in most countries, and if you have more than that percent of alcohol in your blood, then you're disqualified from driving. If you do drive, you get into trouble. I forget exactly what percentage that is, because I don't drive or drink, so I don't really pay attention to that. But even small amounts of alcohol, that does affect your mindfulness. So if it's such a small amount, it doesn't affect anything, then it's okay. If it does affect it, then be careful. Especially if you're driving, or you have, you know, you're like a doctor or a nurse or something, because you notice one small mistake, you get the dosage of the medicine wrong. Instead of 10 milliliters, you've got 100 milliliters. You still kill that person. So this is one of the problems with drugs, like alcohol. They're very dangerous. And it's a strange thing with our societies that, you know, drugs like marijuana, the dangers are well seen, but alcohol, I don't know why, as a society we've allowed that alcohol, when it creates huge amounts of problems in our society. You think it's fun, you just go and enjoy yourself and just, you know, go and get drunk. But there's a lot of people just get huge amounts of problems because of drinking. They're both, you know, ruining their health. Sometimes that, you know, they come home and they just literally beat their wife. They just don't know what they're doing. And they get into all sorts of trouble. And sometimes, as a monk, because I do funeral services, one of the most tragic funeral services I did was for this, I think she was a Chinese girl, it could have been from Hong Kong. And she was just, she migrated to Australia for a better life. She's a very brilliant lady at school, got a degree, got some sort of really good job in Perth. She was the only child. And so after a few months, she invited her mother and father over to come and also to live in Perth so she could look after them. The mother and father had never been to a foreign country, could not speak English, didn't really know what they were doing. The daughter was just looking after them. And she was just shopping, walking on the pavement, when a couple of drunken kids lost control of the car and just mowed her down and killed her. And she had been doing nothing dangerous at all, just walking in the proper places, with a couple of drunks driving a car when they shouldn't have done, lost control and killed her. I always remember just the faces of her parents who just lost their only child, and then they were in a country whose language they couldn't understand, completely abandoned, completely at sea, not knowing what to do next, just so confused, just because a couple of stupid kids had got drunk and they thought what great fun it was, not realizing what the consequences are. So really be careful with alcohol. You can have much, much more fun without it. And I tell this to, like, in youth groups. You know, young boys, young girls, young boys think about young girls, young girls think about young boys. That's what I was like when I gave up alcohol. And I tell them, look, if you don't get drunk at a party, if you don't drink at all, you can actually enjoy your girlfriend much more. You're more alert and more aware, and the best part of the party was the last part. When I used to drink, you couldn't remember what you were doing. But when you didn't drink, you could remember everything, and it was good fun. So if you like pleasure as a young boy, a young girl, don't get drunk, don't even drink anything. You'll enjoy yourself much more. You're more alert. What is the criteria to be a nun? Once you said it's difficult for me and a female to become a nun compared to a male to become a monk. Why? A lot of it is because the situations for, especially in Theravada, to have places where you can be supported, where you have your cooties, where you have everything necessary to be a female monastic. In Mahayana it's much easier because, look, there's two nuns here. The nuns are actually probably more, well, maybe not as well looked after, but certainly as looked after as the female monastics, as the male monastics, as the monks. In Theravada, it was just the, you know, the nuns were just really not given equality. So in places like Australia, we've been working very hard to make a nuns' monastery, now, exactly the same as a monks' monastery. But our nuns' monastery in Perth, as many of you know, one of the ladies from Ipoh, Sui Peng, is there at the moment and is going to be ordained as a nun in the next month or two. I forget when I'm supposed to ordain her. But it's so popular that there's a waiting list there. So it'd be great that you have more places for nuns, like little forests. You've got Akachita's Sasanaraka. You should have Sasanaraki for the women. So you should go and do it. So there's a place where sort of Malaysian women could actually get exactly the same support and be good nuns. Simply because we do need more teachers. And I've already mentioned that women, actually when it comes to meditation, you usually do a better job of it than the men do. So you've got all this talent sitting there. Look how many women are on this retreat compared to the men. You've got all this untapped resource. So, you know, get a nuns monastery together as soon as possible. And then, if it does become easy then, for women to become nuns. It's going to happen, for sure. It's just a matter of time. The sooner you get it going, the better. Because many, many women want to have the full opportunity to go straight for enlightenment in the monastic orders and really give out to the world. People say that, but the truth of the matter is that you can ordain a nun, a bhikkhuni, any time. If you have a look at actually the original text, there are two ways to ordain a bhikkhuni. One is actually in both sides, the bhikkhuni sangha and the monk sangha. But as many people have pointed out, and it's true, you can look at that original Pali of the Vinaya, the legalese, and you can say that no, just being ordained by the monks is enough to make a full bhikkhuni. So it's really just politics, that's all. The opportunity is there, if you really want to. So we can start, we've already got bhikkhunis, they've already started. But the point being though, the most difficult part is, do you really want to be a bhikkhuni? Because some of the old rules there were just so tough, much tougher than for the monks. And so that's why in places like Perth, you say, let's actually just solve the problem by doing a bit of lateral thinking. We have these, they're not just 10 precepts, they keep exactly the same rules as the monks, the nuns in Perth. But we don't call them bhikkhunis or 10 preceptors. We give them a different name, we call them nuns. We call these guys monks. By changing the name, we give equality. And anyone who's ever been to Perth will see that those monks and nuns are treated equally, they've got the equal respect. If you call them bhikkhunis or samaneris, straight away you're into trouble of the hierarchies. If you call them monks and nuns, the problem is solved. Sometimes all that needs is actually a bit of creative thinking, a bit of language to solve these age-old problems. This is actually sometimes that politicians know how to solve problems with changing language. And a few months ago I went to a talk by one of the ex-Governor Generals of Australia. And he told this very funny anecdote. He said that some years ago there was a very wealthy family in the US who wanted to have their family history written in a book. So they hired a professional writer, an author. And they gave him the instructions that they wanted to have a family history written, and that he would be honest and accurate. But if there was any scandals, he would, you know, just cover them over lightly. You know, the sort of, instead of always focusing on the two bad bits. He wanted to be honest and accurate history, but one which presented the family in a very good light. And very soon, when he found out the family history, the author came across a big problem. There was one of the members of the family, Uncle Jack, was a very naughty man. He'd actually raped somebody, and he was caught, sentenced to death, and executed in the electric chair. And the author said, how on earth am I going to present that in a good light? But where there's a will, there's a way. And so this is what he wrote. He wrote, Uncle Jack, in the later part of his life, he was appointed to a chair of applied electricity in a famous national institution. And when he died, it came as a shock. Which was not lying, but it certainly wasn't telling the truth. So sometimes a bit of creative language can do very well. Next question. Is it necessary to offer food to our departed loved ones when we pray to them? Can we offer the food to the Sangha, then transfer the merits to them? Can they enjoy the food in this way? Yes, they can. You don't even need to offer them food, just to make some good karma. You can say, keep precepts for 9 days, 8 precepts. And you offer all of that good karma for your departed relations. So it's like on Chinese New Year, you can actually give somebody a present, give your father a present, find out what he wants. Or you can give him sort of some money, so he can actually choose what he wants. Now if you just actually offer the food to your departed relations, that's all they get. If you offer them just good karma, it's like offering them like a gold credit card. They can, if they want food, they can have food. If they want clothes, they can have clothes. Whatever they want, because it's a general gift. So that's obviously much better for your departed relations. They should say, good karma which I've made today, I give to you. And they can, if they want food, they can get food, clothes, whatever they want. It's like giving money instead of a particular item. at a birthday or a Christmas. That's the best way. Okay, well, is it safe for just anyone? There's two questions here. I said one, never mind. Is it safe for just one, anyone, non-Buddhist, to carry out this meditation in their own home? Safe meaning retaining their sanity without minds being infiltrated, influenced by unnatural forces. It is the only danger in your own homes is not meditating. Because if you don't meditate it, then you certainly will be infiltrated, influenced by unwholesome forces like greed, hatred, delusion, selfishness and all that sort of stuff. So the danger is not meditating. And you can see, you know, you may have a husband, because he doesn't meditate, he gets infiltrated by all sorts of unnatural forces like whiskey, like other women. They're the dangers. You know me, you've heard me say this before. Those of you who are afraid of unnatural forces, the most dangerous ghost around in the world today is the bottle ghost. Remember the bottle ghost? That's so dangerous. If you haven't heard of the bottle ghost before, let me tell you, that bottle ghost actually can kill people. It drives them crazy. They really do go insane for a while when they're entranced by the bottle ghost. And this is not a myth. You've probably seen it yourself. The bottle ghost is so called because it lives in bottles of whiskey and beer. And when you take off the cork or the cap, that bottle, and you start drinking it, the bottle ghost goes right inside of you. You get possessed and you say crazy things. You go dancing up and down just like a mad person, and sometimes you can kill yourself. So that's the bottle ghost. The most dangerous ghost that has been proved to exist. You see it yourself. So if you're worried about, you know, unnatural forces, and most Chinese people are so worried about spirits, except the real ones, the alcoholic spirits. So please, be worried about that one. That's a dangerous one. But as far as meditation, it's one of the safest things you can do. So, it's unsafe not to meditate. It's safe to meditate. Is there any procedure before starting the meditation, like chanting, etc.? No, the only procedure is sit down, shut up, be mindful. And the band part, should there be no figure of the Buddha? Is it necessary, or can the showing of respect come from the heart? It can come from the heart. You don't need to bow to people. One of the best reasons people bow these days, though, is because it exercises your stomach muscles and you don't tend to get so fat. So if you're putting on weight, bow some more. It's also a nice way of respect. Dear Ajahn Brahm, what actually are orbs? Strange optical bright light balls that appear in digital photos of some persons placed on the night sky. Could they be due to devas? Have you seen those deva lights on those photographs? Are they real? Or are they just dust? What are they? He who knows shouldn't say. He who says doesn't know. Actually, just because I'm a scientist, I asked one of the monks to send some of those deva-like photos to the photographic laboratory and ask for an explanation. And the letter came back from the laboratory saying there's only two explanations. One is that it's actually dust on the lens, the other one is dust inside the lens. And if you've seen those photographs, both are just unacceptable. Because you take two successive photographs, one after the other, one has the lights, the other one doesn't. And the next one doesn't again. So if it was dust on the camera, where's the dust gone? It's just suddenly disappeared. Strange, but true. Dear Ajahn Brahm, can a person lead two lives at the same time? One in the human body on earth, and the other in another dimension above the earthly realms. Does astral travel exist? Astral travel exists, but when you're astral traveling, you're leaving your body. This body over here is just like hibernating for a while. So you're not actually living two lives at the same time. Because, you know, your body's just left behind for a while, you're just floating away somewhere. You always come back again. If you do ever astral travel when you're meditating, don't be afraid. Nothing wrong will happen to you. You'll find your body again. All you need to do is just stay very calm, be very peaceful, time to go home. Or just come back. Whatever. The worst thing is when you get afraid and you get pulled back so quickly. It's really jarring and very unpleasant. So don't worry about it. You go floating off. Enjoy it. There's many of my disciples. There's a funny story about floating off. This one of these guys, he was living in Perth, but he was an engineer and got a job in Darwin, which is about 2,000 kilometres away. So he went off to Darwin, but he was a very jealous man, jealous of his wife, so he'd always come back every few days in his astral body to check out what his wife was up to. So that's a marvellous thing, that, you know, you can actually be here on retreat, your husband may be in KL, you don't know what he's up to, but you can just go and leave and check him out, see what he's up to at any time, and he doesn't know you're watching. Isn't that a good thing to do? This other guy, he was one of my disciples in prison, and so I don't know how many years he was in jail for, but he could astral travel. And he said it didn't really matter being in jail, you could go watch a movie any time you wanted. And they couldn't stop him. He just went out of his body and went, so. Body levitating is just the power of the mind again. Sometimes the mind can be so strong. And it always happens when you get huge amounts of joy and happiness. This pity becomes so strong. And your body becomes so light. And sometimes all you need to do is make a little resolution. And you find it sort of floating up. But that doesn't mean too very much. But all of these powers, you have to have purity of mind. And there's this classic story about levitation. I don't know if it's in the commentary somewhere. I don't know actually where the origin is, but it's a very classic story. There was a monk who lived in a forest. Really good meditator, lived so simply, very pure hearted, kept all his monastic precepts, a great monk. Over the years he learned how to levitate. And this was natural. He just, you know, went floating around, you know, flying through the forest. And this is what happens if you show off, because one day somebody saw him, the forester. And of course, if you see somebody levitating, you'll tell your friends. And the friends saw him levitating as well, and soon the word got to the town, soon it got to the city, soon it got to the king. And the king always wanted to see someone levitate. You know, like, wouldn't you like to see someone levitating just once in your life? So, you know, you haven't got any authority, but kings have. So the king sent sort of some of his army to that monk to invite him to the palace to show off, you know, his tricks. And when the monk said, "No, look, I don't want to go to the palace, I'm a simple living monk, I'm happy in my forest here, and if you want to listen to the Dharma, I can teach the Dharma, but, you know, otherwise, just please leave me alone." But the generals were under orders, and so, as they used to say in that old movie, The Godfather, the generals made him an offer he couldn't refuse. In other words, they forced him to go to the city. And the king was quite reasonable about it. The king actually, in his palace, had a little bit of a wood in his palace grounds, and he built a nice little kuti there, and he said, "Monk, you stay in this kuti, it's just exactly the same as being in the forest. I'd even get some forest animals there for you to make you feel at home. But just once a week, I want to come and just discuss Dhamma with you, so you can be my teacher. And you can levitate, you can do whatever you want. I'll make sure you're well fed, but just once a week, I want to come and get a teaching from you." And the monk said, "Oh, okay, fair enough. It's just the same for me, a forest or this little wood in the middle of the palace." So that was the arrangement. And it was working very well. You know, servants would bring him food every day. He'd go off flying around and meditating. And once a week the king would come to him and he'd give him some advice about, you know, ruling the kingdom, some Dharma, be a good person. It was a wonderful arrangement for a while. But then what happened one day, he was off flying around the palace grounds, levitating, as he usually did. But this day, instead of the servants bringing the food, It is one of the king's daughters, and it's an incredibly beautiful princess. She decided she wants to make some merit, so she was bringing the food to this monk's hut. And as the monk was flying back to his hut, he saw this very beautiful girl, the princess. And he had just one moment of lust for her, and he lost all his psychic powers. So he had to do what we call a crash landing. That poor old monk was bruised and broken, so immediately he realized the dangers of living in the palace. There's always going to be, you know, if he hadn't got an absolutely pure mind, just one moment of lust, and he lost it all. And so after his meal, he packed up his belongings. He couldn't fly back, he had to walk back days and days and days back to his forest. And it took him a couple of years, it says, to get his levitation powers back. So that's what happens. Psychic powers are so sensitive, just one unwholesome state of mind, and you lose it. Which is good in a sense. It means that if you do have psychic powers, you can't misuse them at all. If you get ill will, lust, or whatever, you can't sort of use that to, you know, for your own power to manipulate others. So that's what happened to him. So you've got to be very pure to have these psychic powers. Ajahn Brahm, this adage, practice makes perfect, applied to meditation practice. The more we meditate consistently on our own every day, the better we are able to advance to reach the jhana stages one fine day. Yeah, of course. The more you practice, the more you incline to peace of mind, the quicker it gets. But it's not just the time you spend in meditation, it's the quality time you spend in meditation. So in other words, if you put wisdom power, not just patience, always wonder, why am I not peaceful? Why can I get peaceful? When I do get peaceful, what did I do? And what's this trick about meditation? What does letting go really mean? What is contentment? When I strive, what happens? When I let go, what happens? And what is peace of mind? Why are there barriers to peace of mind? Why can I get so far and I can't go further? What's the attachment? What's the craving? So this is actually where insight, which gives rise to wisdom power, is so powerful. So don't just meditate there hour after hour, just going through the motions. Be sharp, understand why, what works, what doesn't work for you. And then you become an efficient meditator. So you really learn quickly. If you learn quickly, you get deep very quickly. So don't just sit there, thinking the more hours you spend there, the quicker you become enlightened. Now use your mental faculties as well. Be sharp. How long did it take you to reach jhana stage since you started meditation? Well, if you were starting to think about all the previous lives, it's been eons since I got... But when did you start? That's a hard question. And you don't know how long you've been going. The point of the question is that when will I get jhana, you're asking. And the point is, you don't know how close you are. The next meditation could be your one. Anyone who's got a deep meditation, they can never see it coming. It always comes as a surprise. They never expect it. They never see signs. It's never like you sit down and say, now you're going to get a jhana, this meditation, here I am, I'm coming, be prepared. It just happens when you least expect it. So, do you expect to get a jhana in the next meditation? If you don't, that's a good sign. Ajahn, may I ask, did Lord Buddha start teaching Theravada scriptures followed by Mahayana and Vajrayana so as to give instructions for those who wish to achieve Buddhahood? Did all these three recited by Ananda? Because in a lot of Mahayana texts they say those who aspire to be arahats or even arahats themselves are skeptical of these teachings as they only know the path of liberation but not believing in skillful means of liberating. Is that true? It's not true. Many of those teachings in the Mahayana are new teachings that are added later on, same with the Vajrayana. One of the troubles with the Tibetan tradition was they never had any good idea of the chronology, the time of these suttas. Because they all came from places like Nalanda University, And they didn't have at that time any idea of which was old, which was new. The whole lot got very quite confused. So what we do have though, in all of the traditions, whether it's Vajrayana, Mahayana, Theravada, we have a core group of teachings, a core group of sutras, which are common to us all. So we have the common group of sutras, or agamas in the Chinese Tipitaka. On top of that, we have what each tradition has added. Such as the Theravada has added the Abhidharma, I don't mind saying that. Now the Mahayana added things like the Heart Sutra or the Lotus Sutra. And the Vajrayana has added many other sutras as well. But we all got a common core. And if you go to the common core, you know, things like Eightfold Path, you know, like meditation, like Satipatthana, Seven Enlightenment Factors, you know, non-self, those are the core teachings of Buddhism. And that core teaching is what the Buddha taught. I mentioned this earlier on. The Buddha said that he has no closed fist. He didn't hide. There were no secret teachings. The Buddha said that clearly. And number two, he said, even though there's no secret teachings, there's many teachings which I haven't given you. But the reason I haven't given it to you is because they've got nothing to do with the past. So he never taught sort of geography or quantum physics or sort of accountancy, because that's got nothing to do with getting enlightened. Nevertheless, those things can all be very true and very valid. But he gave the core teachings, and those core teachings are common to all traditions. And if actually you get people who practice rather than just be the scholars, always be aware, be wary of the scholars. Those who've read all the books but haven't understood them. If you read the books but don't understand them, you haven't internalized them, practiced it and understood, then you'd always say, oh, this is better than that one. You haven't really understood what these things are talking about. When you've actually practiced, it's wonderful to meet really good Tibetan monks, nuns, Mahayana monks and nuns, who take all of these sutras, understand what they all mean, go to the heart of it, and then we all agree. And none of us who are practitioners, who have attained anything, will ever say, this is the most perfect of the sects of Buddhism. This is the best, this is the highest. You'll never say that. That's a good sign you've misunderstood what the teachings are. You say, I said yesterday, it's ego. I've got the best path. The most superior path is that the Thai forest Buddhist tradition under Ajahn Chah. We are the best. If you hear me say that, you're quite free to give me a kick up the backside. That's stupid. The point is that truth is superior freedom, wherever you find that. There's no such thing as a superior guidebook or menu. The food is the most important, not the teaching, not the menus. So, the Lord Buddha, the Buddha taught Eightfold Path, Sila Samadhi Panya, taught all these wonderful skillful means. And all those skillful means, some of which, you'd say for example, you've heard here, some of it is from the sutras. Some of it is pure Ajahn Brahm, never been said before, but it doesn't matter. Go to the core ones, what's added afterwards, they can be helpful, as long as they're not contradictory with the core. So find out what the core teachings are. And everything else is Abhidharma, Heart Sutra. There's nothing wrong with the Heart Sutra. It's got some very beautiful teachings in there, but it's not original Buddhism. It's not taught by the Buddha. So you can make use of it, like you can make use of opening the door of your heart. It was not written by the Buddha. But you can make use of it. So this is what we do then. During the morning metta meditation, I don't seem to be able to see the golden light. Am I missing anything? Although my usual reaction of metta of having my hair on my arms and back stand did occur. That's good enough. You don't have to follow me exactly. I'm just giving examples. But you wanted actually to have metta meditation every morning. And so I did it the way which works for me. If it doesn't work for you, you can, you know, plug your ears and do your own metta meditation, or just go around the corner and do it yourself. And it gives you an example. And some of it, in a retreat, we're trying to give examples, teachers, so that when you leave here, you can stand by yourself, sit by yourself. And so you get some idea. The main reason I teach metta like that is because too often traditional metta teachings, you start with yourself first of all, and many people find it hard to really get lots of metta towards themselves at the beginning. However, if you find any object which is easy to get metta towards, your child, your son or your daughter or something there, especially if they're sick, poor thing, you get loving kindness coming up very quickly. Once you've got the spark, the first flame, it's easy to actually to build it up. And you build it up on this person and that person. What I haven't done so far with metta meditation is once you've got the fire really strong, then you put on your enemies. The people who've really hurt you, been mean to you, who've stolen your money, who've tricked you, cheated you. Those are what I call the wet, sappy logs. And it's very hard to make a wet, sappy log take a flame. But if you have a huge fire already, the wettest, sappiest of logs, you can chuck on that fire, and there's so much heat there, it soon dries it up, all the moisture, and soon that log is on fire as well. This is what I mean, you have to build up loving kindness on your friends, first of all. When it's really, really strong, it feels so much energy of loving kindness. Then you can think of your enemy. Poor thing. You've got so much loving kindness that even your enemy, they take your loving kindness as well. It just dries all of the ill will away. And it just bursts into flame. And you're really surprised at how people who you thought there's no way in the world you can ever like them, let alone give them kindness, you find you can. That's how you love your enemies, by loving your friends first. Next question. When meditating on a chair, is it true that the back must not lean onto the back of the chair? Not necessary. You can if you want. Just be comfortable, whatever your body wants to do. Don't look at other people. Your body is completely unique. If you want to lean on the back of the chair, that's fine. You want to take it away from the back, if that feels more comfortable, that's fine. Next time you can come on one of these retreats, bring your armchair, one of these lady boys. You press a button and the feet rest comes up. This is what meditation's all about. But I guarantee that if you bring it here, you just leave it in the back there, when you want to sit on it, I guarantee someone else has already pitched it. Make your body comfortable, be kind. As I practice present moment awareness of the breath, thinking and mental chattering come and go. However, as pain comes and intensifies, my mind goes and anchors on the pain. When this happens, there is little thinking, mental chattering. Awareness of the breath fades as the attention is focused on the pain. Can the attention be just sustained on the pain until awareness decides to go back to the breath? Thank you. You know what that's called when you're aware of the pain? Anapanasati. Mindfulness along the pain. And that was not a meditation taught by the Buddha. So, if you keep on getting pain, often, if it's just every now and again, but most times you're free of pain, it doesn't matter, just focusing on the pain every now and again. But if that becomes a regular practice, you have to look at your posture and get some more cushions. If you want some more cushions, there's a heap of cushions behind that wall over there. Get some more. See how many. I've seen in the men's dormitory this incredible number of mattresses and cushions there. Bring them all out. So you got a cushion under here, a cushion over there. Make yourself comfortable. Or sit in a chair so you're not always in pain. Because the last thing you want is meditation retreat to be too painful. Every now and again it has to happen, but if it's constantly happening, look after your posture, look after your body. One of my fellow monks, he's now the abbot of our monastery in Northumberland, is a wonderful monk. I don't know if any of you know Ajahn Manindo. May have heard of him. He's a great monk, just about the same age as me. He decided to go through his pain once. He was sitting down, they got pain in his knees. I'm not going to move, I'm going to just endure it. He ended up having to have two knee operations in the hospital. Stupid thing to do. But he never does that anymore. He learned his lesson. So the pain is a reminder to you that the body is actually wants you to move it. So be kind to your body. If it's too much pain, then move. You get much deeper meditation when you're comfortable. Next question. Can the recitation of mantras with intense concentration lead to absorption states of the mind? Thank you. You do mantras at the beginning. But if you don't let go of the mantra, you can never get into absorption. Simply because the mantra is too coarse. It's still like this noting the thinking going on. The words are still happening. So you can do like, even like, may all beings be happy and well. May all beings be happy and well. But after you say those words like that, listen afterwards. What happens in your mind after the words finish? May all beings be happy and well. The mind is turned to metta. So you keep on saying that mantra until the feeling is so strong inside you, you don't need to say the word anymore. Like peace. 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 Can you feel yourself getting peaceful? This is what happens. You say the word until it brings out the effect. And you just linger with the effect for a while. When the effect starts to fade away, peace. 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 You feel peaceful again. When it fades away, start the mantra up again. After a while, the peace is so well established, you don't need to say the word anymore. You have peace and it's stable. That's what a mantra does. The mantra brings up where it's pointing to. Buddho, Buddho. Until the mind sees Buddha, the awakened one, the enlightened one, the peaceful one. You're at peace, you're alert, having fun. Then you don't need to say the mantra anymore. So the mantra is at the beginning stage. It's the same that many of you, like look at me, I came in an aircraft from Perth to KL. That's as far as the aircraft could go. I couldn't get the captain to come and land in this centre here in Ipoh. You can't take an aircraft into this temple. So I had to get out of the aircraft, and then I travelled in car. And even in the vehicle, we could only go to the car park. I couldn't get the vehicle to please drop me off outside my room. It just can't go that far. So I went in the vehicle as far as the vehicle could go, and then I went on foot. So these different vehicles can only take you so far. So mantras only take you so far. Then you get off the mantra and say, go off into a nimitta. Nimittas only take you so far. You get off the nimitta and just go into this beautiful, joyful peace. So each vehicle only takes you so far. The mantras take you so far, soon you have to let them go to get on the next stage. In present moment awareness, we open all our senses to feel the world so as to bring our attention to present moment. But in beautiful breath, we limit our senses only to mind door and turn off all other senses. Am I correct that we're doing two opposite things? Not two opposite things, almost like two complementary things. The first thing is you let go of time. You keep all the sensory experience. It's a gradual letting go. So first of all, you just let go of time and wondering about the minutes and the hours and the days. You'll be so amazed when you leave here in a few days' time. Just how peaceful you've become and how just wonderful it is to be timeless. As soon as you go back out there, you've got to get to work on time, you've got to do this job on time, you've got 2 hours to do this, 5 minutes to do that. Oh, it's just such a pain having to worry about time and not being late, getting there on time. So enjoy this moments of timelessness where you've got no schedule, just eating, but some of you don't even eat. Who cares? So enjoy this moment, but present moment awareness is the first stage of letting go. You let go of time. And afterwards you let go of both of the senses, just to keep part of the sense. Then you let go of that sense to get to a nimitta. So it's a gradual letting go. So you don't try and let go all in one go. So what if there is no one there in emptiness, no self? Absolutely, I agree with that. So what? It's a great question. So what if there is no one there? Emptiness. Ajahn, is an imitator of devas and celestial beings an illusion of the mind? Thank you. If those limiters come along early in the meditation, you've got no power, no stillness, then it probably is just an illusion. However, if the mind is really still, and you've got lots of energy and peace, you start to see these things, there's a good chance the more still you are, the more powerful the mind is, the more likely it closer to the truth. There are such things. This is how they are seen, experienced. It really depends on your state of mind. Bhante, what is the meaning of the precept in Pali? Metta sahagatena chetasa sabbapana hitesu paritsava viharanang samadhiyami. That's actually not a precept, but that's actually part of spreading loving kindness. Metta sahagatena chetasa, a mind which is endowed, which is literally gone with loving kindness. Sabbapana hitesu. Bhutesu should be, Pana Bhutesu, Paritava, having spread that to all beings, all breathing beings, Viharanang, that we live in that abiding, we determine that. So it's not really a precept, it's just the determination to actually to live with compassion and kindness to all sentient beings. That's what it means in Pali. It's a determination, Adhitana. Dear Ajahn, if one, due to lack of wisdom, has an abortion during their teens, or one had to abort due to financial reasons, and now realizes it is against the precepts, what should one do, I think, to overcome this fear and remorse feelings? Please help, Metta. Okay, if you've had an abortion, because you were young or financial reasons, as I mentioned, I think, earlier, it's not quite the same as like killing a big, fully mature human being. That's actually, even the commentaries point that out, that, okay, killing all living beings is wrong, but there is a lot of difference between, like, killing an ant and, like, you know, killing your husband, say. First of all, the consequences in law are very different. But even the feelings and remorse you have are much different. I'm not saying that one is right and the other is wrong, but there's gradations of bad karma. And much of those gradations of bad karma depends upon the intentions, the circumstances. Like even in law, if one is crazy or drunk or something and one kills somebody, and if one's out of one's mind, it's looked upon as being less culpable. So if it's financial reasons or whatever and one commits an abortion, it's still a little bit of bad karma. The thing to do is acknowledge it. Yeah, you know, be honest with yourself, forgive it, which means that you don't try and punish yourself and learn from it. And obviously the thing to learn is, you know, as a woman, just be more protective of your body. And there's this lust, as I said, is craziness, and at the time you don't think of the consequences of your actions, but you know, there are consequences. You know, so, you know, if you're a sexually active young teenager, then at least, you know, have some contraception, so you don't have that problem in future. But also, maybe to think that, why am I so sexually active? So, you know, ask those questions of yourself, and be a bit more restrained. And it's okay to say no to your boyfriend. If he really loves you, if he's worth anything, he's not going to dump you because you say no, because you refuse to have sex with him. That's actually a good test to see whether, you know, he really cares for you or not. And it's also, it shows you've got integrity, that you're standing up for yourself, which you have to do in relationships. So don't be crazy because of lust and get into those, you know, very awkward situations of being pregnant. But if it does happen, you've made a mistake. Don't be too tough on yourself. If you really want to do a penance because you've had an abortion, find a cat and give it 50 strokes. That 50 strokes of the cat. It means that you aren't compassionate enough to yourself. You've had a tough decision to make, and you've made that decision. And no one can punish you for that, only yourself. And I say that later on in your life, you know, you probably, you know, will have a nice relationship, maybe get pregnant again and have a child. And maybe it's that child which you once aborted. They're just waiting to come in. So you haven't really killed them, you just delayed their arrival into your life. And I like that saying, you know, you don't sort of kill the child, you delay their arrival into your life. I say that because I know just how women feel when they've had an abortion. It's such a tough decision to make. No man can understand what you go through. So because of that, you just be incredibly compassionate. And don't ever call someone who commits an abortion murderer, murderer, murderer. That's just really unkind. However, it is a problem, and we don't want to have too many abortions, or if any, if we could possibly make it. So find out what the cause is. Be a bit more careful with your sexuality and your relationships. No, it's okay to say no. If you are sexually active, yeah, get some contraception, please. And so you don't have that terrible problem, which is complicating so much. Okay? Ajahn, where did the mind originate? Aha! The mind originated in craving. Craving, desire, is the origin of things. It causes things to happen. And some people say, well, what caused craving? The mind caused that craving. You say, well, you just said craving caused the mind, and now mind caused craving. He said, yes. It's one of those great chicken and egg questions. And look, we accept it with chickens and eggs. You know, where did the chicken come from? An egg. But you have to have a chicken before you have the egg. You have to have an egg before you have the chicken. So which started, the egg or the chicken? The same thing, the mind. Where did it come from? From craving. And I like to say that because you see, right now, craving, desire, creates the mind. And mind creates the craving. But I like to look at it this moment, on that craving creates the mind. If you have craving, you create this very hard and very suffering and painful mind. So if you stop that craving, you get the Buddha mind, the awakened mind, which disappears. You've uncreated your mind. You've gone to emptiness. That's why, when you stop craving, you stop the mind. And then you understand where mind comes from, or where mind ends. The end of craving is the end of the mind. Isn't that nice? Anyway, I was taught in the beginning that rebirth takes place instantaneously after death. Now I'm also told that there is also an intermediate stage where a person wanders around waiting for rebirth, confused and does not realize that he is dead. The Vedas call it the Vardha stage. Please comment further. Yeah, the only way you know whether you get reborn immediately or you wander around is wait until you die, and you'll find out for yourself. However, the reason that became a controversy is that I'm a Theravada monk, and I am staunch Theravada, but Theravada makes mistakes, such as the Abhidharma, and that's one of the Abhidharma's mistakes, where they start to say there is no intermediate stage, as soon as you die you get immediately reborn. But I know that's not the facts. There are such things as ghosts waiting to be reborn. People remember their past lives, they know that state between their births. And even in the suttas, when you read the original teachings of the Buddha even in a couple of suttas, he says, yes, there is an intermediate state. And when you actually see that in the suttas, you realize the Abhidharma got it wrong. So, yes, there is an intermediate state. The problem in Theravada came from monks who just look at the Abhidharma, they don't look at the suttas, they've got no personal experience of their past lives, don't understand how the mind works. Because of that, they say there's no intermediate state. The fact is, in that case, the Tibetans are right, and the Abhidharmas are wrong. But if you don't believe me, wait until you die, and if I'm wrong, you can come and haunt me. Acha Brahm, you didn't tell it right. Oh, I'm going to make sure you never speak again throughout the whole of your life because of what you told me. There's an intermediate state. I was told, and if there isn't an intermediate state, you won't be able to do that, so I'm safe. Ajahn, I was told if one died, okay, this one. I was told if one just died and you feel the forehead and it is still warm, it means that she died with a peaceful mind. Hence will result in going to heaven and will have a good rebirth. Likewise, if the last thing which feels warm is below the waist, it means you go to hell. Is this truth? Also, why is it that sometimes one dies with their eyes open? Okay, that is a myth. And that's actually traced to one of the Mahayana philosophers, very famous in Vajrayana, called Asanga. And he wrote this treatise, and he's the first guy who said that, which is absolutely ridiculous. Any doctors here? Medics? Well, you'd all know that the last organ of the body which receives all of the attention is the brain. Because that is the most, with the heart, the two most essential parts of your life faculty. And everybody knows if you have an injury, all the blood just goes up to the brain. Because that is so important to keep you alive. You may lose your leg, you may lose your arms, but the brain is the most important. So it happens in every case when a person dies, the blood goes to the brain at last. That is always the last thing which is warm. Now, what that means is, this is a scam which some monks get up to. You may be a father who's never gone to the temple, drunk a lot of alcohol, maybe had a few mistresses, and you think, filial piety, I've got to do some chanting for my father to make sure he goes to heaven. So you get all these monks up there, they chant, charge a lot of money, and in the end they say, his head is warm, he's going to heaven, twice the price please, or whatever. It's worked, you see, he's gone to heaven. It doesn't happen that way. If a person's been that bad, they've not kept precepts, they've been an adulterer or whatever, all the chanting won't help them. Their head will still be warm at the end, because everybody's head is warm at the end. So it is actually a scam. So don't believe that. You know if a person's going to heaven or hell by their conduct in this lifetime. And even the chanting at the end, this is actually what the Buddha said from the suttas. He said when a person asks, all this chanting when a person dies, is it actually, can it send bad people up to heaven? Or, if you don't like them, good people down to hell? Can you actually chant and actually interfere with karma that much? And the Buddha gave this wonderful simile. He said, imagine you have a pot of ghee, like this oil, a clay pot containing oil. And you throw it from a height onto, say, a pond, so it smashes when it hits the water. He said, the oil will float on the surface, and all the shards of pottery will go down to the bottom. Now suppose you got a great monk or a Brahmin, and you got them to sit by that lake, to chant so the clay bits and pieces will come to the top, and so the ghee will fall to the bottom. Will they be able to do that? He said, no, the Buddha, because it's the nature for the oil to float to the top, and from the heavier pottery to go down to the bottom. Exactly. In the same way, when a person has done bad karma, all the chanting in the world won't lift them up, because it's their nature to go down. If someone's done good karma, all the chanting in the world won't take them down, so their nature is to go up. The only place where chanting can really happen, where they're on the edge, and they're not really going down, not really going up. And there the chanting can do a little bit to help. They can't do that much. So what really helps in your life is not the chanting you get in the end. Don't think, I can be a scallywag, I can have many mistresses, and I can not give any donations, I don't need to keep the precepts, because Ajahn Brahm has promised to chant for me at my funeral. No. It just doesn't work. Lastly, can you Please comment on the newspaper report regarding Buddhist monks in Sri Lanka protesting the government's plan to share the tsunami aid fund with the Tamil Tigers. I must admit I don't know all the ins and outs of why they're doing that, but to me it doesn't sound very Buddhist at all. I think it's very maybe nationalistic. They think that maybe if you share that fund you're giving acknowledgement of the Tamil Tigers' existence, you're giving them legitimacy, and I don't think that's going in the right way. The Buddhist monks should be selfless and just say, if you need the funds, please have them. I don't think it's really solving the problem there. But unfortunately sometimes the Buddhist monks can be very nationalistic and just think of their own country rather than thinking, you know, that Buddhist monks shouldn't have a country. They belong to the world. That's why sometimes people ask me, you're a Buddhist monk, but when, say, Australia and Sri Lanka are playing cricket, which team do you support? Because I've got many Sri Lankan disciples. But I live in Australia, and Australians are mad keen on cricket. And I say, I support whichever team is winning. That way I am always happy. Doesn't that make more sense? Now, I know some of you go backwards and forwards between Malaysia and Singapore. If Malaysia and Singapore are playing a soccer match, who do you support? Why not support the team which is winning? So, like, be a person who has got no nation. And then you don't get into one of these problems about Tamil Tigers and our nation, that Sri Lanka is, you know, has always been this way. Like nations and tribes is a case of so much war. You know, whether we're Chinese or English or... I'm not Chinese, I'm an Ang Mo. Who cares what you call yourself? You're just good fun. I've learned a few words in my time in Singapore and Malaysia. Who cares what you are? Because on the outside, no matter what colour you are, your blood is red, your bones are white, and your tears are salty, and your laughter has the same sound. So why do we always try to think that, you know, there is Sri Lanka and there's the rest of the world, and there is Malaysia and there's the people surrounding, you know, there is the United States and all our enemies? That's not the way for a peaceful world. So one of the great things about our modern life is because we travel to each other's countries, because we marry, we intermarry. You may have a son-in-law who's English, you have a daughter-in-law who's French, you may have someone who's married to an African, and I think it's great. So all this intermarriage, so it's going to get harder and harder to decide actually what race or what country we belong to. And as soon as we do that, I think the better this world will be. So I think the Sri Lankan monks there can't really understand what they're doing. Okay, so I've answered all the questions. I've gone on for a bit of a long time, but at least I've answered the questions. And now is interview time. So, for those of you who have personal questions, please keep it short, because I've gone on a bit long. It's only an hour and a half for lunchtime, so short questions to the point for the interview time. Okay? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.